Welcome to Radioactive Magazine. We have two guests with us tonight. We have Dr. David Terry, an MD for here in Kansas City, and we also have Wendell Potter, who's been an activist for Medicare for All and a very known activist for many years. I'm going to have Dr. David Terry introduce himself, and then he's going to introduce Wendell, and I want to welcome you both to Radioactive Magazine.
Well, thank you, Bill.
And David, and then we'll just let Wendell go.
So a little bit about my background. I'm a physician practicing 35 years. I've been board certified in obstetrics and gynecology as well as in psychiatry, and I have definitely seen the changes within the medical system resulting in this large elephant in the room in which concern for patient care is really not a prime target in the medical industry. I am really excited and pleased to be able to introduce Wendell Potter, who first gained national attention in testifying as a whistleblower in front of Congress about the misinformation that was disseminated by the insurance industry. He's authored a number of books, including Nation on the Take and Deadly Spin. He's a investigative journalist and founder of tarbell.org. He is a passionate activist and proponent for a single-payer system in Medicare for All, and he is currently the president of the Business Initiative for Health Policy. So, Wendell, it's a pleasure to meet you and a pleasure to introduce you. Thanks.
Well, Dick, thank you so much. I really appreciate that great introduction. And I must say, I was being called an advocate, even still to this day, surprised me a bit, because I'm looking back, kind of an accidental advocate, and almost was pushed into advocacy to a certain extent. I spent 20 years inside the health insurance business. Before that, I was a newspaper reporter, so I was a journalist in my first career, and I kind of come full circle, and I'm doing journalism again. But I had a longer career as a head of corporate communications for two of the largest health insurance companies in the country, Humana and then Cigna. And I left after a crisis of conscience, and I left because I just couldn't keep doing what I was doing. There were a series of things that led to that crisis of conscience, and I left in 2008, so it's been 10 years now. And that was just as, the election was going to be held a few months after I left, and then after the first of the year when President Obama was inaugurated and Congress really got down to the business of looking at health care reform, I thought I could work behind the scenes and help advocates understand what my old employer was going to be up to try to influence that debate and to try as best they could to, if they couldn't kill it, to shape it to their liking. But they eventually persuaded me that if I really wanted to make a difference, I had to go public. So they kind of pushed me into the arena, and I've stayed in it ever since.
It seems like one of the things that was headway in your career as an advocate was your testifying in front of Congress about misinformation.
Oh, exactly. And that was one of the things I felt I could contribute to the debate and to help lawmakers and the public understand. I testified before a Senate committee. Jay Rockefeller at the time was chairing the Senate Commerce Committee, and he and his staff invited me to testify. And what I decided to do was just kind of pull the curtains back to help them understand how the industry really operates, to enlighten them on some very common business practices that were making it so difficult, if not impossible, for people to get insurance that they could afford, and in some cases couldn't get at any price because of business practices of the insurance industry. But I also explained how the industry went about misleading people, and I was a part of that directly. I was part of the propaganda team, if you will, for the industry to help develop public relations strategies and implement them to scare people away from reform, to make people terrified of the term single payer and terrified of the Canadian system, misleading people about both. And that was one of the reasons I felt that I needed to do what I ultimately did. I felt that I needed to make amends for all that work I had done in my career to mislead people about the status of our healthcare system and to help confuse people about other healthcare systems and how they organized their care and how they were able to bring everyone into coverage and operate much more efficiently and less expensively than we do. So ever since then, I've been continuing that process or that making amends that I sometimes call it, going around the country and talking to people and trying to really, in fact, I do tell the truth these days and tell people what I used to do for a living.
I'm wondering if you could describe some of those practices that the industry uses to profit from our fears.
Well, absolutely. And I'll go back to some that, fortunately, the Affordable Care Act outlawed and that I told Congress about. One was charging people who had been sick in the past, people with pre-existing conditions, a whole lot more than they charged anybody else who was healthier. And in many cases, they blackballed people. People may not realize this, but before the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies denied about a third of the applicants that they got through the individual market because they didn't want to take on the risk of insuring someone who they thought might have some high medical claims down the road. They had a list of about 400 conditions that they used to either charge people more because of those conditions that someone might have, or refuse to sell them coverage at all. And in many cases, people who had heart conditions, who had been treated for cancer in the past, they were just out of luck in terms of getting coverage if they had to buy it through the individual market. And a lot of us do then and now have to do that because we do not have access to coverage through an employer. So that was one practice. Unfortunately, the Affordable Care Act made that illegal. They can no longer blackball people, and they cannot charge people more because they have a pre-existing condition than other people. And keep this in mind, almost all of us, if you don't have a pre-existing condition today, as we get older, the chances increase. And by the time we are in our 50s and 60, the vast majority of us have at least one pre-existing condition, as you well know, being a physician. So that was one thing. Another was kicking young people off their families' policies when they turned 18. And it was very hard for young people to be able to afford coverage on their own. So the Affordable Care Act requires insurance companies to allow young people to stay on their parents' policies until they turn 26. So that was a big thing. Also in the past, insurance companies charged older people far, far more than they were willing, than they charged people who were younger for the exact same policy. Sometimes 5 times as much and sometimes 10 times as much. And in some states, there was no limit. They could charge whatever they wanted without constraint. And the Affordable Care Act restrained that. They can charge older people 3 times as much as younger people, but that's far better than what the world was like before. And they used to charge women more than men, and that's now unlawful. One thing that I told the Congress about was this practice of purging. The insurance industry insured a lot of small businesses, but small businesses sometimes would have 1 or 2 workers who would get very sick and needed expensive care. So what the insurance industry would do to try to get rid of those accounts would be to jack the rates up so high that small business had no option except to essentially pay a ransom or to drop coverage or make the workers pay a lot more for their coverage. And that's one of the reasons why so many small businesses drop coverage and don't offer coverage yet today, because they just simply couldn't afford it, and many of them were purged. And the insurance companies also were spending far, far less every year of our premium dollars on care. And they did that because that's what Wall Street demanded. A lot of these insurance companies are publicly traded companies, and the first priority for the insurance company's executives is to enhance shareholder value. The shareholders are stakeholder number one for those guys, and they want to make sure that they, every 3 months, can demonstrate that they have enhanced that shareholder value. In other words, made those shareholders a little bit richer. And one way of doing that was to spend less and less over the years on our health care, on paying claims, so that there'd be more left to reward shareholders and executives and to put into sales and marketing and PR campaigns and lobbying campaigns.
We're seeing now an increase in the deductibles that we have in insurance.
Yep.
And we're also seeing new insurance plans coming out in which there is no pre-existing conditions that are very, I want to say, inexpensive but cheap in value.
Yeah.
Could you comment about what's happening?
They are. And what we're seeing is the reemergence of junk insurance. And I use that term very deliberately, because a lot of these plans that are now being able to be marketed once again, they were essentially outlawed by the Affordable Care Act. The current administration is allowing them to be sold again. There are policies that are cheap or cheaper, and people don't realize just how cheap they are and how little value they can be if you really need your coverage. People don't realize, in some cases, what it means to not have coverage for a pre-existing condition. And they don't really understand the trade-offs when they sign up for a plan that has a very high deductible. We have a growing number of people who are underinsured in this country. We still have 28 to 30 million people even yet who don't have insurance. And that's one of the reasons I advocate for going much beyond the Affordable Care Act to a Medicare for All type program, because we haven't gotten anywhere close to universal coverage in this country. But also, the insurance industry, one of the things that was not outlawed was the use of high deductible plans. And the insurance industry wants to move every last one of us into a high deductible plan. And it's been a strategy of the industry for a long time. It was also a reason why I quit my job, because I knew that these plans were not good for everybody. They're not good for people who are getting older. They're not good for people who have health problems. They're not good for people who have modest incomes. If you're healthy and wealthy and young, yeah, these might be good for you, but that doesn't cover a big segment of the population. So more and more people are finding themselves in these high deductible plans. They sign up for them because the premiums are a bit less than other plans that have a lower deductible, and people are gambling that they won't get sick or injured and have to pay very much out of their own pockets. But unfortunately, the way the world is, a lot of people do get sick. They do come down with they do get cancer. They do have heart problems. They have heart attacks. They are in accidents. And even still in this country, the leading cause of bankruptcy is medical debt. And a lot of those people who file for bankruptcy have insurance, but they're in these high deductible plans that they thought would protect them, but they have to spend so much money out of their own pockets before their coverage kicks in that people often are have no option except when they have high hospital bills, even with insurance, but to file bankruptcy. And a lot of people in these plans forego needed care. They don't get the care that they need because they just don't have the money to spend out of pocket for care that they should be getting, but that is not covered until they meet their deductible. We have a situation in which people are insured, but in these plans they really can't afford to use. It's just an absurd situation, and that's yet another reason why I'm advocating for much more sweeping, transformative change than what we got with the Affordable Care Act.
Even now with Medicare, there are some limitations, but it's better than having a private system. Could you explain how Medicare itself would benefit us all?
Yeah, and throw in on that too, as far as a lot of people complain that if we had I'm going to say socialized medicine because it's such a buzzword for a lot of people, but our taxes would go up, and they never talk about maybe other expenses that might be offset. So kind of work that in there as well, or either.
Well, absolutely. And by the way, the term socialized medicine, that's one of the terms that in my old job I use all the time. We used it to scare people because we know in this country we have a history of the word socialism having a very negative connotation, and so we knew it was a term to scare people. In PR, and I was in PR for a long time, there's this acronym called FUD, F-U-D, and it stands for Fear, Uncertainty, and Doubt. And these campaigns that the industry puts on, and we'll see that, by the way, and just forewarn everyone that we're going to see these FUD campaigns back in action in probably soon after the first of the year when a new Congress takes office. But these campaigns are designed to scare people, to make people afraid of change, to make people doubt what they're hearing about change that would be to their advantage. And to make them doubt, to make them uncertain, and to make them fear. So there is that. I can't tell you, I've been doing this now for about 10 years, giving talks around the country, and even before the Affordable Care Act was passed, and I cannot tell you how many people I have talked to over the years who have told me they are counting the days until they are eligible for Medicare, because they either can't afford commercial insurance, private insurance, or they're in a plan that doesn't cover them adequately. And a lot of plans, you mentioned high deductibles, but a lot of plans have what the industry calls narrow networks or skinny networks. They limit these plans, and this is becoming very prevalent. The vast majority of health plans now that are sold by private insurance companies restrict which doctors you can go to and which hospitals you can go to and even which drugs they'll pay for. So this is something that is not known in Medicare, and it's one of the reasons why so many people that I've talked to, again, they can't, they're counting the days until they're eligible to enroll in Medicare. Medicare has been and continues to be the most popular way of getting coverage in this country by far. And yes, sometimes we hear that socialized medicine. Well, that's when you consider that Medicare is a publicly funded but privately delivered health care program. By that I mean it's a government program that finances the care, but our care is delivered by doctors and hospitals in the private sector. That, by a lot of definitions, I guess, would be socialized medicine, but it's used, that term, to scare people away from actually one of the most popular and best health care systems in the country, and that being the Medicare system. Now, it has some shortcomings. People do have to pay significant deductibles in Medicare, certainly for some services they get. It now covers preventive care, and there now is a drug benefit. So it has been improved over the years, but still a lot of people make the choice of getting a Medigap policy or a supplemental policy to help them cover their out-of-pocket expenses. So it's not perfect. There's a lot that can be improved upon, but it is far more popular with the people who enrolled in those in the Medicare program, in the traditional Medicare program, than people who are enrolled in private insurance. It's you never have to worry about losing it, and that's something that you always have to be worried about in the private sector. A lot of us get our coverage through the workplace, but people need to realize we are all just one layoff away from being in the ranks of the uninsured. We've been reading about, hearing about GM laying off thousands of its workers around the country. And those people have health insurance right now. When they're laid off, they're going to be out of luck. They're not going to have the same protections that the people who are enrolled in Medicare. Medicare is a kind of guaranteed health care, and that's what we really need for everybody. And you cannot say that anybody who has a private insurance plan can count on it being there tomorrow.
What type of components would you see in a single-payer system that would benefit everyone, benefit our communities?
Yeah, it needs to be broadened to cover certainly everybody, and that can be done. There's no reason why you cannot extend it to cover everybody, and it can be done a lot more efficiently. The overhead expenses for Medicare are just a tiny fraction of the overhead for commercial insurance or private insurance companies. As I said earlier, I mentioned that insurance companies have been spending less and less of a premium dollar for paid claims. The Affordable Care Act requires them to pay at least 85% of their care, 85%. But still, that means that insurance companies can devote 15% to 20% of a premium dollar to overhead and profits. That doesn't happen in Medicare. The administrative expenses in Medicare are 2% to 3% compared to 15% to 20% in the private insurance market. So you have that. The current traditional Medicare program does not cover dental and vision. That needs to be addressed. We need to add that. Access to dental care is very poor in this country. About 130 million people lack access to dental care, and I've seen what that means up close and personal with a lot of folks that I've talked to. So that needs to be brought into coverage. We frankly need to have a better drug benefit than we have. When the prescription drug benefit legislation was passed in 2003, it was an important milestone because Medicare was then going to be starting to cover prescription drugs for the first time. But the insurance companies and the drug companies were so successful with their lobbying efforts that they were able to make it illegal for the Medicare program to negotiate directly with drug companies for lower prices. And so that's one of the reasons we continue to see skyrocketing drug costs and pills that cost $1,000 each or more. We've got to rein in those costs. And so the Medicare program needs to be able to negotiate directly with drug companies and use the power of big numbers to bring those drug prices down. So there's some improvements that we do make. A lot of people advocate for getting rid of the co-payments and the deductibles in the Medicare program, and that can be done. We spend twice as much in this country per capita on health care as any other developed country, or the average of all the other developed countries, and so there's so much waste and so much money that goes into the pockets of shareholders and executives. And are wasted on sales and marketing and paying people like I used to be that don't need to, they don't need, those jobs don't need to exist. There's a lot of money that can be saved. We waste so much money. It's been estimated that we spend about almost $3.5 trillion a year on health care. Again, far, far more than any other developed country. We get so little for it when you compare the health outcomes in the U.S. with other developed countries, and they have managed to operate their systems much more efficiently, so the cost is lower, and their outcomes are better, and they insure everybody. That's where we need to line up.
Okay, yeah, I was just, I wanted to mention that a few weeks ago, I heard a Dr. Ed Weisbart talk about Medicare for All. And there's an efficiency that you both know of, but I just want to kind of say it out loud that, any doctor or any medical facility has to deal with Blue Cross Blue Shield and Humana, you know, the Acme Insurance Company, a dozen others, as well as Medicare and Medicaid. And one of the things that that Dr. Weisbart pointed out is there are so many people in billing to try and just bill for these things that there's a biller, enough billers to have one biller for every person in a hospital bed. So
yeah,
you know, the efficiency of it was called economies of scale when I was in Econ 101. So I just wanted to bring that up. I know you both know that, but I just think it needs to be pointed out.
It's a very good point. When we're talking about these administrative costs, within the insurance companies, a lot of a premium dollar is wasted. But that's not half of it. Because we have these multiple insurance companies that doctors and hospitals have to deal with day in and day out to make sure they're getting paid appropriately, they have to have big staffs of people who do nothing more than get on the phone. You know, their entire shift, they do nothing except haggle with insurance companies. Every one of them does things differently. I mean, and that's why it's so expensive and so anything but cost effective. So hospitals have to have a lot of people who are not engaged in patient care by any means. They're just part of the administrative overhead. And that will go away, too. Now, you often hear, well, what happens? What will happen to all those insurance jobs if we go to single payer? Keep in mind that a lot of people who work for insurance companies are doctors and nurses. There are thousands of nurses that have been hired by these companies to second-guess doctors' opinions. We have this thing in our system, in the private system, called prior authorization. If your doctor says you need to have an expensive procedure, the insurance company will very possibly deny it because they can. And so they get between you and your doctor every single day, and a lot of people don't realize the consequences of that. A lot of people die every day because even though they might have need a transplant and their policy says it's covered, some bureaucrat 2,500 miles away will say, no, I don't think we're going to cover that. And I've seen that happen. That's in fact, there's one case in particular that happened that was a final straw for me, and I walked away from my child. I just could not, in good faith, continue to be a flack for that industry when I saw every day that people were dying because of decisions made by anonymous people and insurance companies.
What would a single-payer system do for the practice of medicine for the physician? As I'm sure that they're scared, too.
Some physicians are wary of it, but there are a lot of physicians who are very, very supportive, and there's some physicians' organizations that are among the leading advocates of the single-payer system. There's one organization called Physicians for a National Health Program, and I know that Dr. Ed Weisbart, who you mentioned earlier, is a member of that organization and the leader in Missouri. A lot of doctors are supportive of it. Some are wary. Some have bought the same propaganda that other people have bought and worry and are afraid of what it might mean to their incomes. One of the things they need to know is that doctors in Canada and other countries that have been able to achieve universal coverage are paid well. And they don't necessarily, there would not necessarily be a drop in their take-home pay. In fact, some doctors, I'm sure, would do a lot better. There have been studies that have shown, in fact, the American Medical Association does this analysis on a regular basis. And the current figure is this, that every doctor, on average in this country, has to spend $100,000 of the revenue that comes into the practice on this overhead, has to spend that much money dealing with insurance companies. And that's that largely would go away. It's just extraordinary. People don't realize how much money is wasted and how much money doctors have to spend under the current system. And in the current system, too, it's such a headache. The decisions are second-guessed, often overruled, and they have to, in many cases, get on the phones themselves with bureaucrats at insurance companies to try to get some approval from an insurance company for a patient's treatment.
Okay, and that, with that, we're going to have to close because we ran completely out of time. But this has been a fascinating discussion, and you can hear much more from Wendell Potter because he is going to be speaking at Unity Temple on the Plaza a week from today, 6:30 at Unity Temple on the Plaza, and I believe that's sponsored by the Physicians for a National Health Plan. Am I saying that right, Doctor?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and that's at 6:30, and it is free. I want to very much thank Wendell Potter for being on the program. I want to thank Dr. David Terry for a great discussion. Thank both of you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Bill. Thank you. Thank you very much.